Hello and welcome to today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Thursday, December 14th, 2023. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Central Nebraska Airport, York's Final Fly-In, Council Bluffs Family, Part of Last Breakfast at Airport. It's written by William Sweet. For 23 years, pilots from around the region have flown to a Central Nebraska airport once a month for an omelet and pancake breakfast. On Saturday, December the 2nd, the York Municipal Airport had its final fly-in breakfast. The York Experimental Aircraft Association chapter had held the breakfast on the first Saturday of every month since the year 2000. Prop plane pilots from Council Bluffs, as well as Nebraskan aviators from Norfolk, Lincoln, and numerous other locations, flew out for the event. Others flew helicopters to get there, and some people drove. Rodney Matlock, vice president of EAA Chapter 1055, told the York New Times that when the chapter met the previous week, they asked each other how much longer they were prepared to host the breakfast. There are only 7 active members of the chapter. At age 70, Matlock is the youngest. They agreed at the chapter meeting last month that it was probably time to end the breakfast. A breakfast group may call to mind a small gathering, but the number of people eating the monthly breakfast usually ranges between 50 and 120, Matlock said. There were 111 on Saturday. The smell of eggs and smoke from the griddle filled the room. The line stretched the width of the hangar at one point. In 23 years, they only ran out of breakfast once, Matlock said. That time, everyone got to eat the breakfast except the cooks who ate at Chances Are restaurant in York. The chapter didn't charge for the breakfast, but they do collect donations, although the finale was completely free. People have been so generous over the years that the chapter has been able to fund aviation school scholarships for area children such as Emily Farley. Farley is now a commercial pilot for a small Lincoln-based aviation company. She had her first experience riding in a plane with Matlock. The fly-in breakfast is an opportunity for community and camaraderie, Fairley told the News Times. We see friends you might only see once a month. Plus, Fairley explained, it gives everyone an opportunity to get out and have some fun. An even younger generation had some representation. Cody Forbush flew all the way from 15 miles east of Council Bluffs with his son Wesley, age 10, and Wesley's friend Julius, age 10. Forbush was kind enough to take the York News Times on a quick trip around York after breakfast. Council Bluffs is not by any means the furthest someone has flown for the breakfast. A pilot from Rifle, a town on the western side of Colorado, once stopped by the York Airport to refuel on the first Sunday of the month, Matlock said. He left with fuel and a big breakfast. Rodney Matlock, along with his son Jesse and his wife Pat, cooked Saturday's breakfast, pancakes, sausages, and a roadkill omelet, which has everything you might want, peppers, onions, cheese, and ham. The chapter is planning to give away the cooking equipment, which includes a refrigerator and a griddle, to a nearby EAA chapter in the hopes that the tradition may live on. The last remaining Nebraska fly-in breakfast takes place the third Saturday each month in Crete. Our next article from the front page of the Daily Nonpareil is entitled 11 Convicted in Fentanyl Trafficking Conspiracy. It's written by David Golbitz. Flanked by members of federal and metro area law enforcement agencies, U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Iowa, Richard Westfall, touted interagency cooperation for the arrests, conviction, and sentencing of 11 members of a fentanyl distribution conspiracy. Triggered by an overdose death in January of 2022 in Council Bluffs, local, state, and federal law enforcement officers worked together to bring the group to justice that was responsible for distributing these drugs, Westfall said Wednesday at a Council Bluffs press conference. The law enforcement agencies involved in the investigation included the Council Bluffs, Omaha, and Bellevue Police Departments, the Southwest Iowa Narcotics Enforcement Task Force, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and the FBI. Together, these officers investigated the conduct of this criminal enterprise both here in western Iowa, in the Council Bluffs area, and in eastern Nebraska, in Omaha and Lincoln, Westfall said. After countless hours doing surveillance and other investigative work, including the execution of 14 search warrants, law enforcement seized 1,500 fentanyl pills, 3 firearms, and $45,000, Westfall said. The 11 conspirators were convicted of a variety of crimes, including conspiracy to distribute fentanyl, carrying firearms in furtherance of the distribution of fentanyl, and distribution of fentanyl resulting in death or serious bodily injury, with sentences ranging from 3.5 years to 30 years in federal prison. This group was responsible for distributing over 100,000 pills in the Iowa-Nebraska area, Westfall said. This resulted in 17 overdoses, 6 of those resulting in death. And for the 11 that weren't resulting in death, those individuals, most of them, if not all of them, required life-saving medical intervention to bring them back to life. That's how dangerous this drug is. Fentanyl is a synthetic opioid, 50 to 100 times stronger than morphine, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In the United States, the rate of overdose deaths involving synthetic opioids in 2021 was nearly 22 times the rate in 2013. Steve Bell, assistant special agent in charge of the DEA's Omaha office, explained that as little as 2 milligrams of fentanyl is enough to kill an average person. In 2023, the DEA has seized more than 180,000 fake pills in Nebraska and Iowa that contained fentanyl, Bell said. What makes matters worse is we're seeing fentanyl in cocaine, we're seeing it in methamphetamine, and we're seeing it in other synthetic drugs, Bell said. So there's absolutely no way to tell any user out there what they're actually taking because we're seeing fentanyl basically in everything. Overdose deaths are the leading cause of death for ages 18 to 49, according to the CDC. In 2022, there were over 100,000 accidental drug poisonings in the United States, Westfall said. 80% of those were fentanyl. In the millions of pills the DEA has seized, 6 in 10 illicit pills contain a lethal dose of fentanyl. According to the Iowa Office on Drug Control Policy, overdoses accounted for 237 deaths in the state in 2022, with more than 200 caused by fentanyl. Gene Cowell, special agent in charge of the FBI's Omaha field office, provided more detail into the investigation and how so many law enforcement agencies came to work together. On January 6, 2022, the Pottawatomie County 911 Communications Center received a call for a 33-year-old woman who was found unconscious and not breathing, Cowell said. Upon the arrival of police, fire, and rescue, she was pronounced dead. She'd purchased 2 pills, Cowell said, and the first pill's toxicity was so great, she died before she took the second one. Through an investigation by the Council Bluffs Department, the woman's death was linked to a previously identified FBI target, which in turn led to the drug trafficking organization. Further investigation connected the drug traffickers to the 17 overdoses and 6 deaths in 2022. At its peak, we believe this enterprise was responsible for distributing 500 to 1,000 pills every day here in our community, Cowell said. We've assessed the Sinaloa cartel to be the likely source of supply for these pills. From its base of operations in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel is considered to be one of the largest drug trafficking organizations in the world. They obtain precursor chemicals largely from China. They manufacture synthetic drugs in Mexico. They move these drugs into the United States. They collect, launder, and transfer the proceeds of their drug sales back home, Cowell said. And they support and enforce all of this activity with a gruesome level of violence. In closing his remarks, Westfall issued a challenge to would-be fentanyl dealers. Those who seek to distribute fentanyl should take notice of this case, Westfall said. It's an example of the consequences they will face if they continue to distribute this drug. And do not doubt our resolve to find, charge, and convict those who are responsible for distributing this drug. Because every trafficker stopped, every pill seized, is an opportunity to prevent this lethal drug from changing other lives and killing other victims. Among those convicted following the investigation were 3 Council Bluffs residents, Megan Kayleen Johnson, age 27, who was sentenced in March to 14 years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl resulting in death or serious bodily injury. Richard Andrew Null, age 26, who was sentenced to 12 and a half years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl and carrying a firearm in furtherance of a drug trafficking crime. And Jarek Matthew McPherson, age 30, who was sentenced recently to 10 years for conspiracy to distribute fentanyl. 65-year-old man dies in crash near Denison. This is written by Kevin Cole of the Omaha World-Herald. A 65-year-old man died in a collision of two semi-trailer trucks Monday about 15 miles south of Denison. Douglas L. Hook of Carroll was taken by ambulance to Crawford County Memorial Hospital, where he was pronounced deceased, according to the Iowa State Patrol. The crash occurred about 4:45 p.m. at the intersection of U.S. Highway 59 and Iowa Highway 141. Investigators determined that Hook was traveling west on Highway 141 in a 2018 Peterbilt truck when it entered the intersection. Hook's truck was struck by a northbound 2015 Freightliner truck driven by Hayden Leonard, age 23, of Millville, Minnesota. The Peterbilt truck came to rest in the northwest ditch. The Freightliner came to a halt west of the intersection on V Avenue. And bridge collapse leads to river contamination. This is written by Jared Strong of the Iowa Capital Dispatch. A private bridge in southwest Iowa collapsed when a tractor loaded with fertilizer attempted to cross it, spilling an unknown amount of fertilizer and about 100 gallons of diesel fuel into the Tarkio River, according to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. The incident was reported about 9:20 a.m. Friday, December the 1st, and happened about 1.5 miles north of Stanton. Clint Means, age 53, of Villisca, was driving the vehicle, a John Deere F4365 high-capacity nutrient applicator, the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office reported. It weighs about 31,000 pounds when it is empty. The vehicle was hauling dry fertilizer, monoammonium phosphate, sulfur, and potash. It fell into the river and went onto its side. Means suffered unspecified serious injuries and was taken to a medical by a medical helicopter to a hospital, the sheriff's office said. The DNR placed absorbent booms downstream to help contain the contamination, and no fish kill was apparent, said Brent Martins, an environmental specialist for the department. He said tests of the river water were pending. The DNR had not determined how much fertilizer might have been spilled into the river. The vehicle has a storage capacity of about 330 cubic feet. The bridge is part of a private driveway that crosses the river, which flows south to the Missouri River. Now we come to a story entitled, Woman Thanks Firefighters for Helping to Save Her Life. It's written by Julie Anderson of the Omaha World-Herald. Jerry Weiser knew something was out of the ordinary when his wife, Chris, told him a little after 6 a.m. on October the 23rd that she didn't feel well and wasn't going to work. It's the one thing we can count on is her going to work, Weiser said. Shortly afterward, she texted him from inside their Council Bluffs home saying she needed his help. She was feeling sick to her stomach. He asked her whether he needed to stay home for a bit. When she said yes, he knew something was wrong. He texted his boss to tell him he wouldn't be in. When he turned around, he saw his wife lying on the bed, gasping. When he couldn't find her pulse, Weiser, a volunteer firefighter in Tabor, Iowa, called 911 and started chest compressions. A minute later, firefighters from Council Bluffs Fire Station No. 5 arrived and took over. They took Chris Weiser to Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Altogether, the then 58-year-old crop insurance underwriter required 62 electric shocks to keep her heart beating. Doctors determined she'd had a heart attack, opened a blocked artery in Weiser's heart, and temporarily placed a pump into her aorta to get more blood into the organ so it could start to recover. Weiser went home 13 days later. On Saturday, she and her husband and more than a half dozen other family members took lunch to the fire station to thank the firefighters for their efforts. I can't thank you guys enough, Jerry Weiser said. You guys gave me my best friend back. I'm so thankful, Chris Weiser said. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you guys and continued care at Jenny Edmondson. Council Bluffs Fire Department Captain Jeff Thielen said it was super important that Jerry Weiser was there and that he started cardiopulmonary resuscitation immediately. Indeed, the Weisers stressed the importance of everyday citizens learning CPR. They and the firefighters, however, said a lot of factors came together that day to contribute to Chris Weiser's survival. Everybody did everything they were trained for, and it showed, Jerry Weiser said. Firefighter Cody Kempf said the crew arrived so quickly because they were returning from another call. Otherwise, they would not have arrived for another 2 or 3 minutes. You maintained circulation long enough for us to get there, he told Jerry Weiser. Overall, only about 10% of those who suffer heart attacks outside hospitals survived the event, according to the National Heart, Lung, Blood, and Blood Institute. But survival rates improve if bystanders start CPR immediately. Studies have shown that bystander CPR can double or triple the chances of survival, according to the American Heart Association. Both Jerry and Chris Weiser, who turned 59 in the hospital, are familiar with the odds. Chris Weiser said her sister died of a heart attack in her sleep at age 59 in 2018. Jerry Weiser has been a volunteer firefighter with various Iowa volunteer departments for 28 years. He also works part-time as a firefighter instructor for the state of Iowa, working mostly with volunteer squads. Rick Benson, the fire department's EMS operations officer, said Chris Weiser was the department's fifth such save of the year. The department since has had a sixth. Over the past 20 years, the department has revived between 30% and 46% of the cardiac arrest patients it has treated, well above the national average of between 10% and 12%. But the crew had its work cut out for it, as did hospital staff. Soon after Jerry Weiser called 911, he heard firefighters in the living room asking where he was. He'd left the door unlocked for Chris Weiser's son, Jake McCoy, whom he'd called after his wife became ill. Symptoms of heart attacks can present differently from those in men. While warning signs in men are more likely to include chest pain and pain in the arm, neck, or jaw, women may experience chest pressure, abdominal pain, sweating, dizziness, and nausea, among other symptoms. The firefighters began a series of life-saving measures and medications. That included fitting Chris Weiser with a Lucas device, which delivers consistent chest compressions and frees firefighters for other tasks. They would get a pulse. It was strong and good. It was strong, a good sign, and then lose it. The firefighters shocked Weiser a total of 7 times during the 19 minutes she was in their care. Hospital staff took over once they arrived at Jenny Edmondson. They, too, had difficulty getting her heart into rhythm. Dr. Robert Armbruster, a cardiologist at Jenny Edmondson, said he told Jerry Weiser at one point that his wife's condition was not looking good. Her relatively young age kept the team going. Once the team got Chris Weiser to the cardiac catheterization lab, Armbruster opened her right coronary artery, which supplies blood to part of the heart, and placed a stent. He also inserted the balloon pump. By evening, she was in the intensive care unit, but showing signs of improvement. Family members had gathered from as far away as Texas. "It's just been like a miracle, almost, that she came through," Armbruster said. "It was that impressive." Chris Weiser said she feels great now. She has undergone cardiac rehabilitation as well as physical, occupational, and speech therapy to address some lingering issues, mostly with eye-hand coordination on her left side. She's eager to catch up with Christmas shopping and get back to work. Meanwhile, her son, as well as her 10-year-old grandson, now want to learn CPR. Based on Chris Weiser's family history, her parents also have survived heart attacks. Her son also has gotten checked for heart risks. Jerry Weiser said his wife's story already has circulated widely among firefighter instructors across the country. "If it can help anybody," Chris Weiser said, "I want it out there." Next up, Hamburg to welcome 33 new affordable homes by 2025. This is written by Liz Skillern of the Southwest Iowa Herald. Hamburg is set to welcome 33 new affordable homes in the spring of 2025. The development, known as North Ridge Acres, is a collaboration between Tamco Properties, LLC, and the City of Hamburg. They have been working closely together since July of 2019. The land was purchased and annexed into the city, which qualified the property for certain grants, said Hamburg Mayor Harry Adams. The land was then sold to Tamco Properties for a nominal fee when she won the bid as the developer. Adams said the work is mostly a combination of the previous mayor, Kathy Crane, and Tamara Brunau, although Adams was involved in the annexation, buying the land, and moving forward. There was a lot of legwork prior to me getting involved. It's exciting because 33 new homes in a little town our size is something major, he said. Brunau is the owner of Tamco Properties and Brunau Contracting. She has experience with rapid disaster contracting and said that's how she was first introduced to Hamburg. I worked on a job in Hamburg in 2008 and 2012 and continued my contact with the mayor. Then, after the flooding disaster in 2019, they called me, Brunau said. She was asked to work on a U.S. Department and Housing Development project using disaster recovery funding. We started working on it, she said. Over the course of the last 4 years, they put together the package for the city, and I won the development side of that. I am the developer and general contractor for their 33 new affordable homes that are going in. The development will be situated near 290th Street and Highway 275. The homes will be specifically tailored to meet the needs of low and middle-income families, with one of the homes being constructed using 3D technology, incorporating innovative intellectual properties from Iowa State. Each home will be accessible, including with an all-inclusive playground and park. Additionally, USDA Rural Development financing may be available to assist families in purchasing these homes. Brunau is happy with the progress so far. We completed infrastructure in 7 weeks from start to finish, and we are ahead of schedule, she said. We start building this spring and should be complete and finished by March of 2025. There are specific regulations that must be followed in selling the homes, including that 80% go to low or moderate income families. Brunau added that they will be taking applications the first 4 months of 2024 and will start with placement of anyone affected by the flood. Anyone in Harrison, Fremont, or Mills counties that were affected by the flood can apply, she said. This project is intended to go right back to residents that lost their homes or were displaced. Brunau said the homes will have 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and a FEMA-rated storm shelter. The intention of these homes was to make sure that everyone and anyone can live in them, Brunau said. We want to make sure that everyone has access to the subdivision and into their homes. In addition to this significant event, Tamco Properties has also purchased and is making available for rental starting in January 2024, a 24-unit low-rent apartment housing near Hamburg's City Park. The Northridge Acres development is expected to have a significant positive impact on the Hamburg community. This project is a major step forward for Hamburg and will help continue the revitalization of our community, Adams said. It's time to turn to the opinion page, and first we have another view from the Wall Street Journal, and it's entitled, White House is Ambushing Drug Patents. Guidance will let the feds steal intellectual property if prices are deemed excessive. While the press frets about former President Donald Trump establishing the Fourth Reich, President Joe Biden is rewriting laws to arrogate sweeping power for himself. The administration recently threatened to seize patents of drugs and other innovations, which could be its most economically destructive executive act to date. The Commerce and Health and Human Services departments are proposing new guidance on march-in rights under the 1980 Bayh-Dole Act. The law that was meant to encourage cooperation among industry, research institutions, and government to bring innovations to market. Biden's patent grab will do the opposite. Bayh-Dole attempted to solve the problem of tens of thousands of government patents that were collecting dust. Government had taken the position that inventions stemming from federally funded research belong to the government. But why develop a product if you won't be allowed to profit from it? Under Bayh-Dole, research institutions receiving federal funds were allowed to patent inventions and license them to companies to commercialize them. It worked. Only in limited circumstances can government march in and confiscate a patent, namely when a company hasn't made a good faith effort to commercialize the research. Progressives for decades have wanted to use march-in rights to seize patents on drugs they claim are too expensive. Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra led the charge last decade in Congress. Yet administrations of both parties have demurred until now because they understood its destructive impact. Under the proposed Biden guidelines, march-in rights will be used as price controls. Government agencies could seize patents if the price or other terms at which the product is currently offered to the public are not reasonable or unreasonably limit availability of the invention to the public. As Biden National Economic Council Director Lael Brainard explained, "We'll make it clear that when drug companies won't sell taxpayer-funded drugs at reasonable prices, we will be prepared to allow other companies to provide those drugs for less." Translation: that's a nice medicine you have there. Shame if something happened to it. Did the White House consult with the National Institutes of Health or other scientific agencies? The NIH this year rejected a petition by a left-wing group to exercise march-in rights on a prostate cancer drug by Pfizer and Astellas Pharma. Note, too, that the administration's plan would let the government seize patents of other products, such as semiconductors, artificial intelligence, nuclear energy, and lithium-ion batteries, and any inventions that result from the $200 billion in funding from last year's CHIPS bill. Stealing intellectual property is now a part of Bidenomics. Our next opinion piece is entitled "Activist Nuns Aren't Likely to Out-Duel Smith & Wesson." This is written by Stephen L. Carter, who is a Bloomberg columnist and professor of law at Yale University. The internet is buzzing about four orders of Roman Catholic nuns filing a shareholder derivative suit against Smith & Wesson Brands. They're seeking to force the company to impose stricter standards for manufacturing and marketing the M&P-15 rifle, which is similar in style to the AR-15. What seems to be getting less attention is the question of whether the lawsuit will succeed. Spoiler alert, almost certainly not. The shareholder derivative suit has long been the bête noire of boards of directors, but plaintiffs in such cases face a tough slog. The board should prevail as long as its actions, even if mistaken, were business judgments made in good faith. For social activists, the slog is tougher still. Consider this. Over the past 3 years, at least 40 shareholder suits have been filed challenging companies for not living up to their own stated diversity goals, but the claims are at best an uneasy fit within the usual boundaries of derivative actions, a difficulty that helps explain why they tend to be dismissed. Derivative suits over social issues are hardly limited to any particular spot on the ideological spectrum. Target Corp faces a suit by an activist shareholder asserting that the retailer lost money by making decisions on LGBTQ issues that were inconsistent with the views of their customers. In the wake of the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, some observers have warned corporations to brace for shareholder suits, claiming that the bottom line is harmed when the board adopts policies assisting employees in traveling to obtain abortions. I wouldn't expect those suits to get far either. And with all due respect to the sincerity of the plaintiffs, I would expect the suit against Smith & Wesson to meet a similar fate. The lawsuit reportedly alleges that the board has not done enough to take into consideration the likelihood of future civil liability for mass shootings. Of particular concern to the plaintiffs is last year's $73 million settlement in the lawsuit against Remington by families who lost members in the Sandy Hook slaughter. According to news reports, the complaint demands that Smith & Wesson alter the gun's design to make the weapon safer and alter marketing practices to reduce the odds that the weapon will wind up in the hands of troubled users. As policy proposals, these ideas might have merit, but it's less clear that they can form an adequate basis for a suit. Weighing the revenues of a product line against the risk of liability is a classic example of business judgment. In 2012, for instance, an Illinois federal court dismissed a shareholder suit alleging that directors of Baxter International, a healthcare company, had breached their duty by allowing the company to sell what the complaint described as a dangerous product. The court explained that even if, as the plaintiffs claimed, the board's efforts to remediate the problem were deeply flawed, the directors were still protected by the business judgment rule as long as they acted in good faith. A derivative suit shouldn't be a device to reverse board decisions that shareholders or judges or commentators think were wrong. As a much-quoted Delaware case notes, even when a board action leads to an actual loss, the standard is not whether the board was right, but whether the decision made was the product of a process that was either deliberately considered in good faith or was otherwise rational. It's hard to see the Nunn's lawsuit getting past that hurdle. I'm not opposed to activist investors who try to focus a corporation's attention on important social issues. That's been going on for a long time, generally to the good. Activism is common, and that's fine. Shareholder activists serve a vital role in the maintenance of shareholder democracy. They force the corporation's owners to grapple openly with issues that might otherwise be swept under the rug. But absent board offenses as serious as fraud or self-dealing or in other ways amounting to gross negligence, shareholders who can't persuade the corporation to adopt their proposals shouldn't be able to enlist the courts in their perhaps justifiable crusades, even when the shareholders are Nunn's. Our final piece on the opinion page today is written by Jonah Goldberg, and it's entitled, "Dictator Comment is a Sad Symptom of Populist Politics." A reminder that Jonah Goldberg is editor-in-chief of thedispatch.com. Politics involves more truth-stretching than most professions. As the line, often misattributed to Mark Twain, goes, politicians and diapers must be changed often and for the same reason. It's also well established that populist politicians lie even more than conventional politicians. This is in part because populism requires fomenting, exploiting, or maintaining a high level of public anger. If you tell the crowd that an issue is complicated, that solutions come with trade-offs, or that your well-intentioned opponents make some fair points, the mob will likely grow bored and lose interest in you. But if you tell them the solutions are obvious and easy, and that your villainous enemies are stopping you from fixing everything, well, that's more like it. What gets less attention is how the deceptions of conventional politicians also create market opportunities for demagogues. You probably heard that Donald Trump, Republican presidential frontrunner, recently said he'd be a dictator on day one of his presidency. Given the growing chatter about how a second Trump presidency would become a dictatorship, Trump's comment threw the commentariat into a tizzy. And understandably so. Whether he was joking or deadly serious or something in between, saying you'll be a dictator for any amount of time is no laughing matter, particularly for a former president who likes to test drive real desires by pretending he's joking. Still, it's worth paying attention to why Trump came up with a one-day dictatorship idea. To recap Fox News' Sean Hannity, trying to help Trump dispel the dictator talk, asked him to assure everyone he wouldn't be one. Trump sidestepped his oft-repeated vow to punish his enemies and said he'd only be a dictator on day one of his presidency for the purpose of closing the border and drilling, drilling, drilling. After that, I'm not a dictator. If you put aside the word dictator for a moment, this promise is sadly banal. Presidential candidates have a habit of dishonestly vowing that they can do all manner of things unilaterally on day one of their presidencies. No wonder voters think presidents have powers they don't have. But this isn't just about presidential power. Consider Trump's vow to issue some sort of day one diktat on oil drilling. Trump is working from the widespread belief among many Republicans that Biden has shut down energy production in America. Trump often says that a lack of drilling is what's been driving massive inflation. "We're going to drill, baby, drill. We're going to bring down your energy costs," he said at a rally last month. "We have the highest energy costs anywhere." By any measure, this is nonsense. Trump often boasts that gas prices were $1.87 per gallon when he left office. They weren't, but they did get that low in April of 2020, only partly thanks to his energy policies. The COVID-19 epidemic smothered demand for gas, thanks in parts to his lockdowns. Meanwhile, under Biden, domestic oil production has hit record highs, surpassing production under Trump and nearly doubling Saudi Arabia's output. We're the largest producer of natural gas by far, producing almost as much as the next three countries, Russia, Iran, and China, combined. One reason most people don't know this is that the Biden administration doesn't brag about surging fossil fuel production because Biden promised to wean the country off fossil fuels. But that's part of the problem, too. Many Democrats want Biden's war on fossil fuels rhetoric to be true as much as Republicans do. It's easy for politicians to mislead when so many people want to be misled. But the lie populist politicians spread most is that our problems are easy to solve and that sinister forces, billionaires, special interests, globalists, big corporations, even Jewish financiers, or just business-as-usual politicians are standing in the way. Steamroll these string pullers and quislings, and everything will be great. That's the language of demagogues and those who help them pave the way for them. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. We'll turn now to today's obituaries. First, we remember Patricia E. Wright, age 87, of Council Bluffs, who passed away December 11, 2023, at her home. She was born February 22, 1936, in Missouri Valley, Iowa, to the late Paul and Mary Beam. She graduated from Missouri Valley High School in 1954 and married Kenneth Wright on June 14, 1958, in Missouri Valley. They were blessed with 9 children. Pat was a homemaker and one hell of a baker. She was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church. In addition to her parents, Pat was preceded in death by her husband, Kenneth, in 2019, son-in-law Dan Hansen, infant brother, and 3 sisters. Recitation of the Rosary Sunday, 5 p.m., followed by visitation with the family until 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Bayless Park Chapel. Memorial Mass, Monday, 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, 4 Valley View Drive. A lunch will immediately follow in the parish hall. Private family interment in Grange Cemetery, Honey Creek, Iowa. The family will direct memorials. Next, we remember Cindy Ann Stricklett, age 62, of Crescent, Iowa, who passed away in Council Bluffs on December the 12th, 2023. Cindy was born April 14, 1961, in Council Bluffs to the late Dean and LaVance Carter. Cindy attended Roosevelt, Wilson, and Thomas Jefferson schools. She worked as a security guard. She was married to Franklin Stricklett. She enjoyed camping, horses, and her family. In addition to her parents, Cindy is preceded in death by her nephew Jake, husband Frank, and those left behind to mourn her include her son Bobby Dean Carter, grandson Cole Allen Seedham, both Crescent, sisters Carolyn Richardson of Omaha, Nebraska, Pam Mule of Riverton, Iowa, Patty Bartholomew of Atlantic, Iowa, Kathy Carter of Council Bluffs, Deanna Church of Missouri Valley, Iowa, and numerous friends. Visitation is Monday, 1 to 2 p.m., followed by memorial service at 2 p.m., all at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. And finally, we remember Edna Joyce Zabel, age 90, who passed away at her daughter's house on December the 12th, 2023. Joyce was born March 17, 1933, in Troy, Kansas, to the late Richard and Ethel Hickson. Joyce was united in marriage to Albert Bud Zabel on September the 20th, 1952. They were blessed with 4 children and raised their family in the Crescent, Iowa area. She was preceded in death by her husband Bud in 2014, granddaughter Wendy, and daughter Deborah Yard. Visitation is Friday from 5 to 7 p.m., funeral service Saturday, 10 a.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Joyce will be laid to rest in Cedar Lawn Cemetery with a luncheon to follow at the Walnut Hill Reception Center. Now it's time to turn to sports, and we'll start with what's on TV today. In college basketball, men's college basketball at 6 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's Jacksonville State at Wisconsin. On the SEC Network, it's East Carolina at Florida. 7 p.m. on FS1, it's St. Thomas of Minnesota at Marquette. College volleyball, 6 p.m. on ESPN, the NCAA tournament, Pittsburgh versus Nebraska, which is a semifinal taking place in Tampa, Florida. And at 8:30 p.m., Texas versus Wisconsin, which is also a semifinal match in Tampa, Florida. In NBA basketball at 6:30 p.m. on NBA TV, it's Cleveland at Boston. And at 9 p.m. on NBA TV, it's Golden State at Los Angeles Clippers. Tonight's Thursday night football game on Amazon Prime Video takes place at 7:15 p.m. and features the Los Angeles Chargers at the Las Vegas Raiders. I'll start with an article entitled, Cardinals Fly Away from Trojans for Third Straight Win. This is girls basketball. It's written by Austin Heinen of the Nonpareil. Class 2A number 14 trainers used two key runs in the third quarter to pull away from Tri-Center in Neola for their third straight win, 56-33. For the majority of the game, I thought we played very well, Cardinals coach Joe Chapman said. Tri-Center came out showing us they were ready, and it was a dogfight in the first half. We missed some shots, and as we went into the third quarter, we wanted to make sure we kept the momentum in our favor, and we got that 7-0 run to get some separation, and from there on, we took care of business. The Cardinals' defense made the first quarter challenging for the Trojans to find any points, but the Cardinal offense wasn't lighting up the scoreboard much to start, but found little mojo as the quarter went on to take an early 11-6 lead. The Cardinal then opened the second quarter with a 7-1 run, and thanks to a steal and score from Josie Lewis, the Cards took a 10-point lead into the break. The Cardinal began pulling away with a strong start in the second half as Ella Tarks sank some early baskets, sparking a 7-0 run. The Cardinals would grow the lead to as big as 17 as they countered a 6-0 spurt from the Trojans to lead 43-26. After having some slow starts in the third quarter in previous games, Chapman was pleased to see the girls execute the halftime adjustments. This group of girls are easy to coach, Chapman said. They love to execute our plans, and when we started the third quarter as we did, we grew our lead, which was exactly what we had in mind, and credit to our kids for staying with it. The Cardinals kept the pressure up and finished the Trojans for their third straight win after starting the season 0-2. I feel like we started a bit slow, but after that, we knew we had to come out and keep working, Schwartz said. I think we started the third quarter really well, and we knew at the half we needed to keep pushing. We knew we needed to get going and move the ball around, and then our scoring picked up, and we put the game away. Alexa Schwartz led trainer with 14 points, and Ella Tarks and Nora Kontz each added 10 points for the Cards. Alexis Flaherty led Tri-Center with 11 points in the Trojans' second loss of the season. Though the Trojans have some work yet to do, Coach Derek Sonderlin has been pleased with what he's seen from his team most of the season and looks to push forward to a strong finish before the holiday break. I like how we played aggressively with them and got to the free throw line, but just couldn't make the free throws, which could have tightened the game up a bit, Sonderlin said. I still commend our kids. I thought they played hard and never gave up, and they continued to work hard and attack. We're going to continue to work at this battle at practice. I like this group of kids, and it takes a lot. It's hard to play good basketball, but they're working hard, and they've been very coachable. Trainer will play again on Thursday when they play Omaha Duquesne on Thursday at the Mid-American Center at 6 p.m. Tri-Center will host Missouri Valley on Friday for a 6 p.m. game. In boys basketball, hot start helps Cards top Trojans. It's written by Austin Heinen of the Nonpareil. Trainer exploded in the first quarter to hand Tri-Center its second straight loss, 75-53 in Neola on Tuesday night. We were definitely clicking offensively and defensively to start the game, Cardinals coach Scott Rucker said. We emphasized defense here and in this game as we didn't feel like we played our best game last Friday, and we were very disciplined with our positioning. But tonight we played very disciplined in the first quarter especially, and that's going to lead to good things with our speed and experience. The Cardinals began the game with a 17-2 run to gain an early lead within the first 4 minutes of the game. The Cardinals offense scorched the Nets for 33 points in the first quarter to build a 22-point advantage after the first 8 minutes. The Cardinals offense cooled down in the following quarter, but it still kept pace with the Trojans as senior Jace Tams and Ethan Cones played hot and broke double digits before the half ended. We really emphasized coming out and starting strong in this game in practice earlier this week, Tams said. We talked about coming out and playing with the right mentality, being ready to go, and we were, and we got up and on them early. Everything started with their defense, Cones said. We strung some stops together and took open shots that fell for us early and helped us build a strong lead early. Tams had 15 at the break and Cones added 10. The Trojans looked to trim down the lead in the second half, but an 8-0 run from the Cardinals boosted Trainer's lead back up to 25. The Trojans made some headway late in the third quarter with an 11-2 run to close the gap to 16 points, but the Cardinals answered with a 6-0 spurt of their own to shut the door and fend off the Trojans for a big road win. It's all about moving the ball around and getting the ball to the open guy, Tams said. When we play unselfish, it really opens everyone up and makes our defense that much better. Our offense that much better. We just try to play unselfish ball, Cones said. Just making the extra pass and creating open shots for everyone. And when we do that, our offense can be really great. Tams led Trainer with 22 points and Cones had 20 for the Cardinals. Carson Elwood scored 11 and Aaron Emke had 10. A.J. Harder led Tri-Center with 20 points in the loss. The Trojans, now with a record of 3 wins and 2 losses on the season, look to end their 2-game skid on Friday as they look to have their young team finish strong in the final 4 games before the holiday break. That rough start buried us tonight, and we've gotten off to 2 slower starts in our last 2 games, Trojans coach Chad Harder said. We are still a work in progress. We have to focus on getting better off to starts. We have to remain versatile, and it's going to take a bit. We're still gelling a lot of groups together. We have to continue to improve with what we have. We really like this team, but there's some little things that we need to tweak yet, but we'll get there. Trainer will play Dennison Schleswig on Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the Mid-America Center. Tri-Center will host Missouri Valley at 7:30 p.m. on Friday. A short little article here entitled Star Awards for AL and TJ Special Olympics Bowling, Esports Team, and Romano. Awards presented at CBCSD School Board meeting on Tuesday. It's written by Peter Burtnett of the Nonpareil. The Abraham Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson Special Olympics Bowling Team, the Abraham Lincoln Fall Esports State Qualifying Team, and the Abraham Lincoln Volleyball Senior Molly Romano were recognized at Tuesday night's CBCSD School Board meeting. The bowling team was given the CBCSD School Board Star Award for placing at the state tournament. The AL Abraham Lincoln Fall Esports team was also given a Star Award for qualifying for the state finals. Romano, meanwhile, was given a star for being named to the 5A First Team All-State Volleyball team. In other high school basketball games from the area, St. Albert girls beat Underwood girls 49-23. Defense. The 6-1 Saints held the 3-3 Eagles to under 10 points in each quarter and just 9 in the entire second half in a dominant win. ACGC 78, AHSTW 57. The 3-2 Vikings ultimately couldn't claw back after allowing 48 first-half points to fall behind by 24 at the break. In boys basketball, Underwood 65, St. Albert 46. The Eagles remain undefeated at 5-0 with a comfortable win over the Falcons. Underwood flew ahead to a 34-20 lead at halftime and never looked back. and ACGC 65, AHSTW 46, somehow the exact same scoreline as the Underwood St. Albert game, the Vikings, with a record of 2-3, had their two-game winning streak snapped. Here's another article with local connection. QBs with Omaha, Council Bluffs ties top Chargers depth chart after Hebert injury. It's written by Peter Burtnett of the Nonpareil. A season-ending injury to Los Angeles Chargers starting quarterback Justin Hebert has given opportunity to a Creighton Prep Junior Jay and Lewis Central Titan to step into the QB1 and backup roles. Franchise quarterback Hebert signed a $252.5 million extension on the first day of training camp, had surgery Tuesday on the broken index finger on his right hand. The injury was suffered in the second quarter of the 24-7 loss to the Denver Broncos on Sunday. Easton Stick will make his first NFL start Thursday night at Las Vegas against the Raiders for the 5-8 Chargers. Stick, just the fourth starting quarterback for the Chargers since 2006, was drafted in the fifth round in the 2019 NFL draft out of North Dakota State. But before playing for the Bison, when he was a four-time FCS national champion and first-team All-American in 2018, Stick played for the Junior Jays. Twice throwing for over 2,000 yards, Stick wrapped up his career at Omaha Creighton Prep with 17 touchdowns and just 4 interceptions. Now Stick will be backed up by a quarterback who played just across the Missouri River at Lewis Central. Max Duggan, added to the active roster after Hebert's injury, was the Chargers' seventh-round selection in this year's draft. Duggan finished second in the Heisman Trophy voting at TCU in the 2022 season, leading the Horned Frogs to the FBS Division I National Championship game. For the Titans, Duggan was a multi-sport athlete but shone brightest on the gridiron, passing for over 2,000 yards and 24 touchdowns while running for over 1,225 on the ground. He was named the 2018 Iowa Gatorade High School Player of the Year. We'll finish up with an article entitled, Have Yourself a Wary Little Christmas. Buying Online, How to Avoid Thefts, Fraud, and Other Seasonal Scams. Social media teems with videos of boxes being swiped off porches. The internet means fraudsters don't have to show you their face to fool you. And the big business of Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa means it's also a busy time of year for criminals. Here's some online shopping tips for getting through the season without being victimized. Don't use public Wi-Fi. Use private networks to keep information you enter into the website from being lifted. Check companies and websites. Don't avoid lower profile, less established companies just because they're not giant retail institutions, but do your homework. Check with the Better Business Bureau for complaints. Search court records where the business is based for any lawsuits. Remember, a company's social media posts really are just advertisements for the business. Don't fall for time pressure. Buy before 10 p.m. Wednesday and get 50% off. If you know you want that item, know it's a good bargain, and are economically ready to press the order button, hit it. But haste makes waste of your hard-earned cash. Their deadline doesn't change whether or not you're ready to buy. Also, Black Friday or Cyber Monday deals often get resurrected during what's become Discount December. Bet that the 50% discount will be offered again, probably advertised with another faux deadline designed to scare you into making a panic buy. If it sounds too good to be true, it usually is. Great bargains are out there as retailers either try to unload less popular stock or just suck you in with loss leaders. Read the fine print. Are you being signed up for more purchases to be billed on autopay? Is the company asking for personal identification information? No retailer really needs your social security number or driver's license. Pay with cards. Both credit cards and debit cards tend to have fraud protection and give you powers to dispute a charge. In the case of a successful dispute, however, the amount gets credited to your credit card account faster than the cash goes back into your bank account linked to your debit card. Gift cards, popular when you don't know what to buy someone, but know they like this store or that restaurant. They also work for quick presents to teachers, office staff, or building staff. Consider the retailer's financial situation before buying a gift card, Florida Attorney General's office says. If the retailer closes or declares bankruptcy, the recipient may not be able to enjoy the card's value. Oh, and here's another tip. No government agency or creditor will accept payment via a gift card. So if you get a phone call saying it's the IRS, Social Security, or a collection agency, and they say you need to make a payment now and they'll accept a gift card, they're fraudsters. Hang up on it. Check the tracking. Before you click the buy button, make sure you've got the right address, then get the tracking number and check it periodically. If the package starts running late or doesn't arrive on time, reach out to the seller. Make specific delivery requests. Request a delivery date and time range so that hits during your time at home. Also, always request the delivery person get a signature from the person who accepts the package. And don't have packages delivered to your home. An argument for spending more time in the office is it might be the best place to have your presence sent if there's a person there to accept deliveries. If your normal routine makes you a nomad during the day, you can opt to have the delivery made somewhere you can pick it up yourself. You can have the item shipped to a store for pickup. Amazon offers lockers and hub lockers, often included with the delivery charge. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.